Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Raisins Takings Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 23, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Horn v. Department of Agriculture. This case presents three questions. The first is whether the government is required by the Fifth Amendment to pay just compensation when seizing personal property, as it must do for real property. The second question is whether the government is exempt from paying just compensation when it seizes personal property if the owner of the property maintains a contingent interest in a share of the value of the property. The third question is whether the government's requirement that property owners hand over specific property in order to be permitted to put their crop on the market amounts to a taking. To discuss the case, we have John Elwood, who is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Vinson & Elkins. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you very much. This case involves the Federal Raisin Marketing Order, which was implemented by the Department of Agriculture under the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act of 1937. Congress enacted the AMAA during the Great Depression in an effort, and this is taken from the government's brief in this case, in an effort to insulate farmers from competitive market forces that it believed caused unreasonable fluctuation in supplies and prices, unquote. So it's a classic New Deal program to sort of tamp down the what they viewed as destructive effects of competition in the market. And the government brief recounts how prices rose and fell in the raisin market in particular as people increased their acreage as they're supposed to when prices are high, and thus caused the prices to respond as you would expect them to by falling thereafter. The raisin marketing order was put in place in 1949. The government argues it's necessary because although demand is stable at about 211,000 tons of raisins per year, and it is inelastic. People don't want any more raisins than that. Supply can be highly variable because the type of grapes that are used can also be used for other items, and so people can, you know, put them into the raisin market and thus cause, you know, really bumper crops in some years. And they, you know, talk about how in one year it may be 240,000 tons, and in the next year it is 430,000 tons, you know, nearly twice as much. So the Raisin Marketing Order gives the Raisin Administrative Committee the ability to limit the amount of raisins that will be sold by handlers in the domestic market. Producers give their raisins to handlers, and then the Raisin Administrative Committee says, you know what, you can only sell, you know, 240,000 tons of those this year, and everything else you got to hold in reserve. And the reserve stuff is titled in the name of the government, even though it stays in the hands of the handlers. It is titled to the government, and they hold on to it. At that point, you know, the raisin handlers only pay the producers, generally speaking, for what is they called the free tonnage, the stuff that they're allowed to sell, and the rest of it they don't get paid for. Then the Raisin Administrative Committee essentially trickles out the rest of the raisins as the market will bear, you know, for school lunch programs or selling them for export, usually at a pretty substantially reduced price. And the Raisin Administrative Committee first pays administrative costs with the money that they make out of that, and then they return whatever is left over to the farmers. To give an example of how this works, you know, overall, and 2002-2003, which is one of the 2 years at issue in this case, 47% of the crop was held in reserve, so literally almost half the crop was titled to the government. That year, they were paid the farmers were paid far below the cost of production and fair market value. The following year, the government took 30%, and they were actually paid nothing because the administrative expenses were very, very high. But in the interest of fairness, for I believe the next 5 years, there were no reserves. That is, that they just didn't vote to have a reserve. The Raisin Administrative Committee didn't, and it was more or less free market or free market-ish. And that there are years with much lighter reserves as well. But it sounds generally from the argument today that reserves have been declared much more sparingly. The Horns at issue in this case, they attempted to avoid the order, which, as I say, only applies to handlers, thinking that if they are raisin producers, if they sold directly to wholesalers, they wouldn't be subject to that reserve and losing the portion of the crop. So they essentially kind of handled it themselves, and they made their own raisins with their own equipment and sold it up directly, and then they leased the stuff to their neighbors, more or less, who did the same deal. And the USDA came after them more or less and said, aha, you guys are handlers, and you know, we're going to take some of those raisins. And the Horns wouldn't do that, so then the USDA essentially said, you got to pay a fine equivalent to that set aside. And in that regard, even though ordinarily handlers or people classified as handlers only pay for the free market raisins, the free tonnage, in this case, the Horns wound up having to pay for everybody, and the producers got 100 cents on the dollar. They were paid for all of the raisins they sold, you know, using the Horns equipment. And so the Horns made out worse than most handlers do. So in any event, during an enforcement proceeding, the Horns sought judicial review through the district court. When the USDA came after them for the fine, the Horns said, this is a taking for you to try to take this, the fine equivalent of the raisins from us, and they tried to interpose that as a constitutional defense. And the district court granted the USDA summary judgment. And in the first go-round, Ninth Circuit, a panel of Hawkins, Gould, and Reinhart held that it lacked jurisdiction over the defense, that it was an uncompensated per se taking. And they said that what the Horns needed to do was pay the fine and then go seek a refund in the Court of Federal Claims under the Tucker Act. And the Supreme Court on the first go-round said that was loopy, more or less, and said you should be able to challenge the constitutionality in district court before you're required to comply. And so they sent it back. On remand, it was the same panel of the Ninth Circuit. And as a little wrinkle, which I have spared you thus far, before the Ninth Circuit said they lacked jurisdiction, they actually held the way they did on remand, more or less. That is, they entered an order holding for the government on the merits, then said, well, we don't have jurisdiction after all. And on remand, they more or less entered something like the original opinion, which said that per se takings doctrine doesn't apply to personal property, it only applies to real property. And then they said, because the Horns retained benefits flowing from the use of raisins by the Raisin Administrative Committee, and they had a contingent right to the proceeds that wasn't spent by the Raisin Administrative Committee, the Horns did not lose all economically valuable use of their personal property, and thus the Ninth Circuit held it wasn't a taking. They said more or less that it was a use restriction rather than a physical taking, and that it satisfied the nexus and rough proportionality rule applied to land use exactions under Nolan versus California Coastal Commission, a 1987 decision of the Supreme Court, and Dolan versus City of Tigard, a 1994 decision of the court. And that pretty much brings us to the second go-around. The Horns petitioned for cert again. The government opposed it again. And I think somewhat surprisingly, the court granted cert a second time. On its second trip to the court, it raises three questions. First, it raises the question whether this is as framed by the petitioner. I haven't attempted to make these more neutral. Whether the categorical duty to pay just compensation when the government physically takes possession of an interest in property applies only to real property and not to personal property. That's the first question. The second question, whether the government can avoid the categorical duty to pay just compensation by reserving a contingent interest in a portion of the value of the property, which is set at the government's discretion. And then finally, third, whether a governmental mandate to relinquish specific identifiable property as a condition on permission to engage in commerce affects a per se taking. Those are the three questions. Brings us to argument today. There was a lot of amicus participation, particularly on the challenger's side. There were quite a number of briefs, including one that I filed on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce. I will try to keep my own biases out of this anyway. There were only two briefs filed, I believe, on behalf of the government, though. One of them for Sun Made Raisins, who is, you know, I think arguably a beneficiary of this order, or at least many of their producers are, we'll see. So the petitioner's lawyer was former judge and current Stanford professor Michael McConnell, who definitely had an easier time today, although he had his own challenges too. Ed Needler, who I think may be the active lawyer who has the most arguments, had real trouble getting traction. He was the lawyer on behalf of the government who argued the case. The court's more liberal members were the only people who really had sharp questions from McConnell, who received friendly questions from Justices Scalia and Alito and more important, and importantly, Justice Kennedy, who is, you know, widely seen as a bellwether, and he doesn't dissent very many times. Initially, McConnell had really tough sledding with questions about how he had grounds to complain if, as he recognized, the government could impose volume restrictions. Right out of the gate, Justice Ginsburg said, you agree that the government could say you can only sell 60% of your crop. You know, why wouldn't that deprive you of all value? Whereas, you know, under this, you get at least some value, at least a contingent interest, and the return of some value of the raisins that are held back. And he initially had trouble getting traction on that argument. You know, Sotomayor followed up with a question, suggesting that his complaint boiled down to the Raisin Administrative Committee having excessively high administrative costs, because that's the part that they lose is, you know, whatever amount that the Raisin Administrative Committee spends on themselves and thus doesn't return to producers. But over time, McConnell gradually made headway, noting that the problem was that their raisins were taken, and that in, you know, there are plenty of agricultural, you know, programs where the producers might say you can only sell 60% of your crop, but they would gradually be allowed to sell the rest of it over time and thus would get all the value of it. And more importantly, that portion of their crop wouldn't be taken. And he had a lot of trouble with that at first, but over time I think that he, you know, made that point to the justices. I think it's a bad sign for the government that several justices, including Justice Kagan and the Chief Justice, and I think Justice Sotomayor, thought during the government's argument to determine how many other programs might be vulnerable if this program is struck down. The answer they got was a handful of programs, like 8 or 10, and that it might, you know, affect a score, although he was fairly vague about that. But I think the thing that is going to hurt the government here is that Ed Needler suggested that most of those programs hadn't used the reserve program in like a decade. And another bad sign, I think, for the government is that Justice Sotomayor asked what the statute of limitations was on takings claims, it's 6 years, and then asked whether any reserve programs had been used during that period, and the answer seemed to be no, suggesting that, you know, the court would feel like it was a fairly low-cost proposition to say these sort of reserve programs are a per se taking, because Uncle Sam wouldn't be out a ton of money for that. It would just be that the Horns could use it as a defense. Ed Needler kept emphasizing that if the petitioners are right, that there has been a per se taking in many years since 1949, which he seemed to think was, you know, an amazing thing to contemplate. But the court seemed relatively unconcerned, I think in part because the statute of limitations has run for virtually all of that. Justice Kagan, who during the first argument mused about whether this was, quote, a takings or it's just the world's most outdated law, unquote, returned to the idea that the court wasn't passing on whether the program, you know, the Raisin Set-Aside program made sense, and that the case could be upheld even if it were a ridiculous program. When Justice Scalia cracked a joke how it certainly didn't help that it was ridiculous, she said, no, this is a serious point, you know, that it may not work all that well, but that the government still has the power to do it. We're not passing on whether it's a sensible program. We're only passing on whether this is an unconstitutional takings. Kagan and Ginsburg and Sotomayor emphasized other programs that were found not to be takings in the past, including, I think it's Leonard versus Earl, involving a requirement that oyster packers in Maryland turn over 10% of their empty shells to the government, and a case where Monsanto had to give up trade secrets in order to produce pesticides. McConnell defended the first as a tax, and also, you know, that was an instance where you were catching wild animals where the government essentially owned them, Maryland essentially owned them, and thus it could, you know, give you as much or as little property right as it wanted in them. And that also Monsanto was different because of the hazards, which is something that Justice Scalia, who I think was the most outspoken of the justices in favor of the challengers here, that was something that he picked up on, that, you know, sure, you might regulate the entry of pesticides into commerce, but not raisins. Justice Breyer was perhaps the most staunch defender of the government's program in some sense, but I don't think he was giving the government the kind of help it really needed, because he was more along the lines, Breyer was more along the lines of saying that, well, it's a takings, the benefits that producers get under the program in the form of higher prices from reducing output at any one time and in the return of payments from what the government sells is just compensation. And the government is trying to say that there's no taking here, it's just a form of regulation. And, you know, McConnell was having trouble making headway on this argument at first, and he acknowledged that in a general sense that this might be a type of in-kind regulation when they, or I'm sorry, in-kind compensation when you get benefits from a program and you also get paid something back. But by the time of his rebuttal over the course of the argument, it appeared that he was finally getting traction with one of his arguments, basically that because this arose in the context of an enforcement proceeding and not some sort of, you know, condemnation proceeding or inverse condemnation proceeding, that it simply didn't, there wasn't a way, there wasn't an outlet for this kind of idea that it was in-kind compensation. That, and he cited to the regulation, which he gave them the number, and it was clear that people were writing it down, that in this kind of enforcement proceeding, you know, that there's just no room for in-kind compensation. The Chief Justice, who sometimes plays his cards very close to his vest, as in the second Obamacare argument that was recently held, was unusually outspoken and I think critical of the government's program. He and Scalia both referred to the program as a taking, and not in the sense that it was a position they seemed to be trying on for size, but that they thought that was really the case. I believe that Breyer also kind of referred to it as a taking, but I think that was more of a trying it on for size, like, you know, say it's a taking, then this is still just compensation. But they seemed to, you know, be willing to say right out there in the open in front of God and everybody that this was a taking. The Chief also emphasized that this was this program was something of an outlier, suggested this wasn't something that would cause problems for other programs. He said, quote, "We are not going to jeopardize the Agricultural Department's marketing programs," unquote. And I think that there was a certain level of unconcern because the justices felt like even if this program is struck down, there will be enough room to regulate. I don't know if you've seen Lyle Denniston's analysis, which seemed very critical of the justices, saying that, you know, that they were, that the imagery had overwhelmed their command of the facts. I think the justices had just fine command of the facts of this case, but it was just they were not that concerned because they feel like this is, they can strike down this program, or the majority of them feels like they can strike down this program and it won't affect the government's other ability to regulate. Because I certainly think that the justices do care about the ability to regulate. Before I saw argument today, I thought that Justice Kennedy would be a big question mark because even though he's a huge free speech guy, he was the guy who upheld cable set-asides for broadcast TV because he thought that was regulation. And, you know, if he thought that this was valid regulation, he might be willing to let it go as well. But I think based on argument today, he is skeptical as well. Also, you know, the Chief made a joke. He said, you know, you went after the raisins and you probably would have done it in the dark of night, which I think was meant as a joke. The Chief also talked about how, you know, if the government's position is right, they could order manufacturers to turn over, you know, one-third of cell phones or one-fifth of cars that are produced and give and require manufacturers to give those to people who couldn't afford them on the theory that that was expanding the market for people and that those people were serving as advertisements. And, Ed Kneedler just didn't have an opportunity really to effectively engage that. I don't know if he would have a good rebuttal of that, but he just didn't engage that. Kennedy, too, was also, you know, a little sarcastic. I don't remember his remarks, but he did use a little gentle sarcasm, which is unusual for him, and I think also was a way of sort of showing his hand. You know, he didn't seem all that concerned about disrupting the government's program. He, you know, summarized his version of the government's argument to McConnell, which obviously is comes across as much more of a friendly question when you're essentially asking a litigant to characterize their opponent's argument. And during the rebuttal, he intervened to protect McConnell's rebuttal time when his colleagues, mostly liberal ones, were asking questions. He said, "You only have 4 minutes. Are there other points you want to make?" Basically allowing him to return to his track after asking Justice Sotomayor's question. I think clearly, if you go through the questions that are being that they presented to the court, I think there is no question that the court is going to hold that personal property is generally subject to per se takings analysis. Not even the government really defended that, and it seemed that there was broad consensus that that was the case. Even Justice Breyer, you know, seemed to be an available vote for that. I also feel like on the question about whether the government can avoid a categorical duty to pay just compensation by reserving a contingent interest and a portion of the value of the property, I think that that is going to be, you know, it seems by my lights to be an easy win for the challengers. I can see, you know, at least a 5-4 vote with the traditional more conservative justices versus the more liberal ones. It seemed to be easy, you know, Kennedy joining the conservatives with Breyer and Kagan seeming like available votes and maybe even Justice Sotomayor being an available vote for a position if narrowly written. And, you know, when you talk about total speculation, looking at the argument calendar for this month, there are only 7 cases. And assuming, you know, that Justice Kennedy were to take the authorship of the majority in the same-sex marriage case, and Justice Scalia takes the opinion in the re-argument of the Armed Career Criminal Act case, I could see the Chief Justice writing an opinion in this case and writing it narrowly enough and, you know, twisting arms enough, because he's always trying to emphasize the importance of unanimity to get potentially even a unanimous opinion, although I think that'd be tougher sledding. One other thing I think that is important to think about is exactly what they will hold, because, you know, this is an enforcement proceeding that is involving individuals who are, you know, potentially on the hook for a lot of money against the government. And the chief is, you know, enough of an on-the-ball guy that he may appreciate that it would be good to bring this case to close once and for all and decide all the issues so that there's basically no need for a remand. But that is, I think, one of the big things to watch on remand, because a decision that wraps everything up would be a really big win for the Horns. They would be out of the case. And, you know, one other thing is that the chief goes for kind of middle dispositions frequently, and so it's also a possibility that he might hand something of a loss to the government but remand for a determination of exactly how much of a loss it is, but that remains to be seen.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.